sci-fi show, Outcast. Welcome to Sci-Fi Show Outcast number 32. Today I have an interview with Dr. Lee Smolin, talking about physics and some of his thoughts and ideas on stuff in general. And this ties in with the interview that I did recently with Bill DeSmet. So, enjoy! Thank you for joining us on the Sci-Fi Show today, Dr. Lee Smolin.
Well, thank you very much.
So, the first question is, can you tell me a bit about yourself, who you are and your background?
I was born in New York City, a theoretical physicist. I live now in Toronto, and I work at Perimeter Institute in Canada, Waterloo.
Okay. And what sort of physics do you specialize in?
Mostly quantum gravity, but generally fundamental physics. Foundations of quantum mechanics, particle physics, cosmology.
Okay. So what is quantum gravity?
Quantum gravity is the search for a theory that would bring together or be the culmination of the revolutions of physics from the 20th century. We overthrew Newtonian mechanics with the discovery or the introduction of general relativity and quantum mechanics, and we would like to have one theory, not two distinct theories for different aspects of phenomena.
Okay. I noticed on your website that you specialized in quantum loop gravity. How is that different?
It's not a question of how it's different. It's a particular approach to quantum gravity. It's a very conservative approach. It comes from taking general relativity seriously and taking the principles of general relativity seriously and applying those principles at the same time as the principles of quantum mechanics. And with no, there's nothing new which is posited. So this is in the real world as we observe it with three dimensions of space and one dimension of time and so forth.
Oh, okay. Now, you've written a book, What is Wrong with Physics? So, what is wrong with
physics? That's not the title of the book. The title of the book, which was meant to be sort of lighthearted and evocative, is The Trouble with Physics.
Oh, sorry. So, what is the trouble with physics?
The trouble that the book is concerned with and is addressed to is the fact that since the early 1970s, there has not been any definitive progress in fundamental physics. And what I mean by that, because I want to make it very clear, I mean, there's been a lot of good work and a lot of interesting things going on. What I mean by definitive progress is when a new theoretical idea or hypothesis is confirmed by a new experiment or a new experimental result is explained by a new a deeper theoretical understanding. I mean, normally in science, experiment and theory go hand in hand, and the concern is that since the middle 1970s, there has not been such a step forward, and for many, many decades preceding that, the progress was rapid, and there were several substantial steps per decade. So I'm concerned with understanding why progress has slowed, and I believe I identified the reason.
Fair enough. And what was that reason that you identified?
Well, you can't. Many people blame it on the lack of experimental data, but one can't do that because, in fact, there's a great deal of experimental data that has not been explained. So maybe it's worth taking a minute and saying that what happened in the middle 1970s, early 1970s, is that all of our understanding of elementary particle physics was understood in the context of a then-new theory, which we call the Standard Model of Elementary Particle Physics. And the Standard Model has been verified by all experiments done since, with one exception, which is that we had to make a small modification to it to account for a discovery, which is that neutrinos have mass, which was not anticipated in the original version of the Standard Model. But that turns out to be a small change, although a mysterious change. We don't understand why neutrinos have mass. And the success to the standard model, however, left a number of questions unanswered, unaccounted for. One of them is the problem of quantum gravity, that is, unifying gravity described by general relativity with the other interactions described by the standard model. Another issue is that the standard model has about 30, taking into account the neutrinos, about 30 free constants or free parameters that just have to be, that's bothersome. Each such parameter is a piece of ignorance, is something that somehow is set by something. So, for example, an example of a parameter, one of these parameters is the mass of the electron, and others are the masses of the different quarks, the mass of the neutrino, the strength of the electric force, the strength of the strong nuclear force that holds the quarks together into protons and neutrons. All these are free parameters, and we would like to understand why they take the values they take.
Okay. Now, you have proposed an explanation for why they take the values they take, with the idea of fecund universes.
That name appears to have appeared on some blogs or something like that. Mostly this theory has been called cosmological natural selection. And it is a possible explanation of how the parameters are set and what sets the values. And it's also testable in the traditional way that scientific theories are testable, which is that they make unambiguous predictions for experiments that could be done to see if the predictions turn out to be right. I didn't write this book to highlight that theory in particular. That was actually the subject of my first book. And that, you know, that is a possible theory, and it makes, unlike a number of the others, it makes predictions, and there are just a few predictions it makes. Those have so far stood up since they were first made in 1992, first published actually in 1992. They were made about 3 years earlier. I don't think that's nearly enough evidence to decide that that theory is true, but it's interesting that one can invent a theory and it can be confronted with some experiment. I think we would need much more evidence to conclude that cosmological natural selection is true, so it's properly seen as a candidate explanation. Most of the other explanations which have been put forward make even fewer experimental predictions. That was one of the things that I was concerned with in the book.
Okay. So what sort of experimental predictions does the idea of cosmological natural selection make?
So it basically mimics the way that biology works and the way that natural selection works in biology. So one of the problems that people have identified, or the mysteries that have identified with the values of these parameters, is that with the values that they're observed to have, we have a universe that has a lot of structural complexity. It allows many, many atomic nuclei to exist and to be stable. Because the electron is much, much lighter than the atomic nuclei, one has chemistry and the whole wealth of chemical reactions. Because there are many stable nuclei, one has the possibility of all the complexity of carbon chemistry. One also has long-lived stars. One has supernovas, as a result of which we have a very energetic cosmos where we have galaxies whose media are active, where star formation is going on, where the media of the galaxies are far from thermal equilibrium. So we have a very lively, complex universe. And if one asks why that's true, part of the reason is that the parameters take rather special values. It turns out that if you change many of those constants by not very large excursions, one disassembles the structure of the universe. If one increases the electric charge, for example, by, I don't remember the exact value, but something like 25%, then all the nuclei become unstable and we live in a much simpler universe. One changes the strength of the weak interaction by a factor of 3, one way or the other, stronger or weaker, then we live in a universe where there are no supernovas. And So the question is how to explain why the values take these very special values, why the parameters take these very special values. And so that's the question that I explored in my first book, Life of Cosmos. And the conjecture of cosmological natural selection is that there is a process by which universes reproduce themselves, and this was not my idea, this is an old idea, through the occurrence of black holes. And inside of black holes, according to Einstein's theory of general relativity, the density of matter and energy becomes infinite. It's what's known as a singularity. And many people expect, and calculations indeed suggest, that when quantum gravity effects are taken into account, those singularities are replaced by bounces, and things continue to exist and to develop in time to the future of the singularity, and that's what we call, that becomes a new region of space-time, what we call a baby universe. And so I took that idea on board and added the idea that the parameters change by small random values when that takes place, and hence I had something which was analogous to natural selection, the way that natural selection works in biology. And just the same way that in biology you reach the conclusion that almost all species are highly fit compared to most alternatives, because most mutations result in a creature which is less fit and would live less, would thrive less well. One reaches the same conclusion that our universe is fit, that is, it reproduces itself more easily or more numerously, has more descendants than other universes with different values of the parameters, and that explains the values of the parameters of our universe. So that's the idea I mentioned, that, and that leads to certain predictions, and those predictions have surprisingly held up.
Now, upon reading of your idea of cosmological natural selection, so you're essentially conceding that the anthropic principle is correct?
No, definitely not. No, the anthropic observation is correct. That is, that the parameters appear to be chosen in such a way as to make the conditions for life possible. The conditions for life, our kind of life, are long-lived stars and complex chemistry. But it turns out that both of those things contribute greatly to the production of black holes. In a world without carbon chemistry, it turns out the clouds, so black holes are the result mostly in our universe of supernovas, and supernovas are the end stage of very massive stars. And those massive stars, it turns out, are born in what are called giant molecular clouds. They're very cold clouds of gas and dust. And one has to ask what cools them, and it turns out what cools them is processes involving carbon monoxide vibrations, and they're also shielded by dust, which is made from ice and carbon dust, soot, and so forth. So the conditions that seem to optimize the production of black holes involve having long-lived stars and involve having carbon chemistry. And so one explains then why the universe is hospitable for our kind of life without invoking it. The problem with the anthropic principle is the reasoning is circular. It says we have to live in a universe where living things could exist, and therefore we live in a universe where living things exist. And by definition, such an attitude or a style of thinking could never actually explain why we live in a universe that's hospitable to life, because it simply assumes it. And that kind of reasoning could never lead to progress in science. I mean, at any stage in science, one could say things are the way they are just because of the way they are and make up some little circular reasoning to confirm that things are the way they are because they are the way they are. And I think it's extremely disappointing when good scientists resort to that kind of illogic. I think either it's because there's something badly that they need to explain or to justify, which otherwise has no justification, or because they're just not thinking very clearly. The whole point of cosmological natural selection, and when I started to worry about the the parameters of the Standard Model was in the late 80s. And maybe just to give some background there, I mean, there had been a great hope that string theory would be unique and would explain the values of the parameters of the Standard Model. And it was clear already by 1986, although it took, you know, really until, you know, 17, 18 years until most string theorists agreed, but it was clear already by 1986 that string theory was going to come in a vast plethora of versions that I called then the landscape of theories, so many that it there would be a problem with predictability. There was an important paper by Andrew Strominger, who's now a professor at Harvard, pointing that out in 1986, and a few of us, many string theorists ignored those arguments and continued for years after to hope that somehow a unique theory would arise. A few of us started to worry about it at that point, and I was one of them. And the anthropic principle was an idea which was around then. It had been invented and studied rather thoroughly by a number of astrophysicists and cosmologists. Already by then, there were books about it, and there were papers about it by philosophers and so forth. So it was pretty clear that there was an anthropic question why the universe was hospitable to life, but it was also very clear that the anthropic principle itself could not provide a scientific explanation or accounting for the mystery that that question raised. So I thought I would try to find one that would do so, and the test of whether a theory does give a possibly convincing scientific account of some mystery is whether it leads to further predictions that are what Karl Popper called falsifiable, which is to say they make predictions that are specific enough and doable that there's a possibility that an experiment could contradict those predictions and therefore, unless you found a way out of it, tell you that that theory was wrong. Without the ability to do that, I know yours is a science fiction show, and science fiction is great, but we want to distinguish science from science fiction and fantasy and mysticism and religion and so forth. And what distinguishes science is that in science, when somebody proposes a possible explanation of something, we demand that it lead to further falsifiable predictions by which we can test whether or not that's actually the explanation that is realized in nature and not just in somebody's imagination. It's very easy to invent explanations. It's very hard to invent the correct explanation. So there's always, for any question or mystery, there's always going to be many more possible answers or possible explanations than real ones. And how we distinguish them is the ability to do experiments and test consequences of them. And that's a very elementary point, but there has been some prominent people who didn't seem to agree with that and in theoretical physics. And one of the reasons, it's not the reason why I wrote my book, but it's why the book took the more programmatic or polemic tone that it did, is because I was very concerned that this point be made clearly. And that I think, you know, it's a very... science and rational thought are under threat from a number of directions around the world, and this is not a time for scientists to be backing off on what the definition of a scientific theory is.
Okay, so how does your theory fare as an alternative to the idea of cosmological fine-tuning? Well, I guess it is a theory of how we get the fine-tuning we do.
Yeah, it isn't. It's the theory of how the fine-tuning might have come to happen.
How does it fare? Is this universe is the universe we're in the one most finely tuned for the production of black holes?
Well, I certainly don't know, and I don't know globally over all possible universes, but those are not the questions we ask in biology. We don't ask if a given individual, a given species are the most... It's not even clear those kind of questions have an answer. I mean, is a typical cat the most optimized possible cat that there might be, or the most optimized predator or something like that, or cute little furry predator? We don't ask questions like that. The question that we can ask is a typical cat more fit than it would be if we randomly changed a number of the genes. So if we explore the space of possible cats by making random mutations to a typical cat, are those typical mutations going to, not in all cases, but in almost all cases, decrease the fitness of the cat, where the definition of the fitness of the cat is the number of offspring it has? And the answer is yes. Many, many years of natural selection have made not perfect cats, but pretty good cats. And so similarly, the question to ask is, if you take the parameters of the standard model and the universe that they make, and you make small random changes into one or a few of the parameters of the standard model, are you going to most of the time get a universe which makes fewer black holes? And the answer is yes, remarkably. And so do you see the analogy? I mean, that's the kind of, it requires a different methodology than we're perhaps used to in physics, but it's the correct methodology faced with a question of this kind. That is, how, if we, and more and more experts in string theory have, not everybody, but more and more have come around to the view that I propose, that there is a landscape of theories, and that as the universe evolves, or new regions of the universe are born, you can develop or evolve on this landscape of theories. And if that's the way the world is, now that could be wrong, but if that's the way the world is, then we have to figure out how to still do science. That is, first, how does the universe select its parameters as it evolves on the landscape of theories? And then how do we as scientists count for that? And again, we must do so by evoking a hypothesis that has testable conclusions. And cosmological natural selection is a proposal or hypothesis that fits that criteria. Is it right or not? As I said earlier, it has stood up, it has made some predictions that might have been falsified in observations done since then and weren't, but I personally don't regard that as convincing. I regard it as, let's keep it on the table as a proposal and see if other proposals. One of the problems, I think, is that the anthropic principle is such a cheap and easy idea that it's sort of seductive, and it's gotten a lot of attention, and not enough attention has been given to try to invent ideas that, like cosmological natural selection, are falsifiable. Although I know a number of colleagues have tried to do so and have thought about doing so.
Okay. Does it avoid a beginning to the universe? Oh, well, multiverse, I suppose. But does it avoid a point of beginning at any point, or?
It postpones that question from the, the, quote, Big Bang of our universe 13 or 14 billion years ago, which is fine because I don't think our theories are up to. I mean, I've actually, since completing the Trouble with Physics, been thinking a lot about the issue of time. Several of the most mysterious, most challenging questions about quantum gravity come down to the nature of time. And the issue about whether the universe has a beginning is one of them. There were some attempts many years ago at answering that question, for example, Steve Hawking's idea of, quote, rotations to imaginary time, or the no boundary proposal. And it turns out to be not so far really possible to make sense of that proposal and similar proposals in the context of, the more contemporary knowledge about quantum theories of gravity and how they have to work. So we don't have a very good conception of how time could, quote, begin. The universe as a whole can have an origin before which there was no time. So it's just as well that to have a cosmological scenario that postpones our confrontation with the question of whether the universe as a whole can have a beginning. I mean, that might happen. I'm a great optimist, so, I'm sure that, there will be many generations of scientists in the future, and the questions that seem totally baffling to us now, as progress slowly accumulates, somebody may in the future be finally able to usefully answer. But I don't think this is it follows that at any one time there are going to be questions that are just too hard for us to, that we don't have the conceptual vocabulary to approach. And I suspect that's one of them.
Okay, so one final question. If people wanted to learn more about your work, where's a good place to go?
Depends on at what level and which work. So, I mean, for cosmological natural selection, I have The Life of the Cosmos. The idea, it's one of those ideas that was born pretty complete, and it's there, along with some thinking about its implications. Most of the work I do in quantum gravity, some of it, the work of, not necessarily my own work, but the work of colleagues and friends in quantum gravity. It's been a lot of good work, and some of it is in recent books by myself and other people. My book, Three Roads to Quantum Gravity, which is already somewhat outdated because it was published in 2001, and a great deal has happened in the field of quantum gravity since then. One thing I certainly recommend is the entire literature of this subject is publicly accessible on a website, archive.org, where that's spelled A-R-X-I-V. And I mean, you have to be a professional scientist to publish the website, just like in a professional journal, but anybody can access it online and search and read papers, the real thing, the real literature, and people are fans of science and want to follow it, then why not follow the real thing? I mean, one may be able not to understand all the technicalities and all the papers, but that's par for the course. I mean, I don't know how to play the saxophone, but I still love to listen to jazz, even if I don't appreciate it with the same completeness of a jazz musician.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time today, Dr. Smolin.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Hope everybody enjoyed that discussion with Dr. Smolin, and next week we'll continue our discussion of the philosophy of science. Till next time. The Sci-Fi Show is copyright Jason Money, 2006. It's released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License, and the song Big Planet is used by permission of Nova Surfer. More great Nova Surfer tracks can be found at novasurfer.ml.